This is the Antisocial Podcast, episode 186, with wealth creation expert Pete Wargent. But before we kick into it, if you are new to the podcast, my name is Andy Dowling. I host this little show, and I'm also the bass player in the Australian metal band Lord, and we have a brand new album coming out the 1st of August called Fallen Idols, and you can check that out right now by going to lord.net.au/FI. I don't know why we didn't do Fallen Idols, but anyway, FI, nice and easy, lord.net.au/FI. There you can find all the details for the upcoming album and pre-order links as well. There's three different pre-order options. You can get the CD on its own, or you can get a CD and a t-shirt, or you can get the deluxe bundle pack, which is a CD, a t-shirt, three patches, which include a back patch and a bonus disc, which is limited to 100 copies, which is karaoke versions of the upcoming album, plus a bunch of exclusive bonus songs as well. And the CD itself that we're doing for pre-order is the Australian edition, which I believe will end up being limited in quantity, which has three exclusive Australian bonus tracks on there. So there is an extra studio track called In Dreams, and there are two cover songs, Break the Ice by John Farnham, oh yes, and Touch the Fire by Icehouse as well. So some really, really cool stuff on there. And please, if you want to support us, please pre-order the album ASAP, because it will help us repay some of our debts. But we're looking forward to putting out this album. The 1st of August is when it goes live, and all the pre-orders will be sent out just before that release date. If you are seeing us on tour, we are getting around the country, starting on the 21st of June in Canberra at The Basement. And the following week, we are going the 28th of June at The Backroom in Brisbane, the 29th of June at Badlands Bar in Perth, the 5th of July at the Evelyn in Melbourne, the 6th of July at Jive Nightclub in Adelaide, and the 26th of July at Crowbar in Sydney. If you're coming to any of those shows and you pre-order the album, let us know and show proof of purchase. Probably give us some advance notice so I bring enough copies, and you can collect your copy, CD only. I'm not going to be providing anything else in advance, but you can collect your CD early from any of those shows if you pre-order the album. So a great way to get the album in your hands before the release date. So make sure you do that if you are interested. lord.net.au/FI. That stands for Fallen Idols. And in addition to playing in a heavy metal band, I'm also the host of the Self-Starter Podcast, which is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. If that's something that floats your boat or tickles a little bit of your interest, you can get over to selfstarter.com.au. Season 2 is out now. And at the time of this episode coming out, I believe episode 31, which is the second episode of season 2, I'll make things complicated for myself, is with Tennille Bond of the Establishment Bar in Dubbo and the Au Revoir Vintage Van. So another cool story there, lots of insights and takeaways. And if you're not familiar with Self-Starter, it's a great way to learn about the world of self-employment. So if you're at a job that you hate and you want to get out and do something on your own, or you've got this great idea that you haven't followed through with yet, Self-Starter might be a little bit of inspiration to get you started. So go and check that all out over at selfstarter.com.au. It's your favorite part of the podcast, shout out time. Every week I thank some incredibly amazing person who supports me and the podcast, and it can be in a range of different ways. It could be a message of encouragement, a guest recommendation. It could be a review somewhere on the internet, doesn't matter where. It could be some merchandise from the online store. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It helps me, big or small, just keeps this whole podcast moving. And this week's shout out is for a familiar person to some of you that have been listening to the podcast for a while. It is Sean Munger. Sorry, Sean. Sean was on episode 173 of the podcast. He is a historian, bit of a tongue twister. No, it's just me. And also is the host of the Second Decade podcast. You can go and check all of that out over at seanmunger.com. That's SEANMUNGER.com, or you can go to episode 173 of the podcast. Highly recommended, very fun chat, and you can go and check all that out. But the reason why Sean is getting a shout out on the podcast is that he has been giving me so much love online via Facebook, LinkedIn, and just like liking all my stuff. He's been shooting me a bunch of messages with some incredible guest recommendations from people within his circles, people that he's come across just, you know, just via his own interests and whatever. And I've got this long list of people that I am going to start going through and hopefully getting on the podcast. Some really, really incredible people. So I really appreciate it, Sean. You just, I've just love the help and the support you've been giving me. And I've really been enjoying the Second Decade podcast as well. I'm subscribed to that and I've been really enjoying those episodes. So for anybody that wants to check out the Second Decade podcast, you can search for it via any podcast player out there. Really easy to find, but go over to episode 173 of the podcast and check it out. Thanks, Sean. Shoot me a message and I'm going to send you out some crap that's lying around my house. I'm going to shoot it all the way to Portland, Oregon. And, we all love getting something in the mail anyway. So thanks, Sean. Appreciate the support. In addition to all of that support, I am going to plug my page, which is andysocial.net/buy stuff. A whole bunch of stuff over there. My eBay and Discogs stores, the Lord and Dominus Records online stores. It's all in one landing page, nice and easy to find. And if you hear me crapping on about all this stuff on the podcast and you decide to order something via any of those channels, please include a little message referring to me and my dribble, and I'm going to add a little extra goodie in with your order just to say thank you. But a few people to thank that have been supporting me via all these platforms include Alexander, why not, from Nord in France, Niels from Camp Lindfort in Germany, Michael from Leipzig in Germany, and my mate Maximiliano from Revere in Massachusetts in the US of A. I fucking love that name, Maximiliano. Max sends me a bunch of messages and always signs off with Max, but, you know, I address it to Maximiliano, so, you know, Max, just keep buying from me so I can keep giving you shout-outs. I might just give you shout-outs anyway. I freaking love that name. Anyway, folks, andysocial.net/buy stuff. Go and check it out and shoot me a DM if you want direct links to the Discogs page or the eBay page or Lord or Dominus Records pages as well. But andysocial.net/buy stuff is the easiest place to go. Episode 186 of the podcast is with international property buyer, finance and real estate expert, author and coach, Pete Wargent. I've got to come up for air after that. I've been stalking Pete for the past several years on the socials. I'm a big fan of what he does. He hangs out with the likes of Michael Yardney and Stephen Ryan, both previous guests of the podcast. And if you enjoy those episodes, you will enjoy this chat with Pete. Pete became financially independent at the age of 33, and he's got a background in accountancy. And he's just got this really cool story to tell about growing up in the UK, starting off his career over there, and relocating to Australia and building this life that he has been able to achieve. And it's just absolutely fantastic. We talk about some really important topics in this chat around money, finances, investing, etc. And it's a lot of stuff that many people shy away from. It's an uncomfortable subject because many of us don't learn this stuff as we're growing up. And just from a generational thing, many of our parents didn't bring this up around the kitchen table, so to speak. So we talk about a lot of these topics. We talk about a lot of approaches that people can take, and it's just a really, really fun chat. There is no financial advice in here. Go and get your own expert advice, as always. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. But there's a lot of cool things that we discuss that will trigger some ideas, hopefully, in your own mind to start your own journey or take that next step in your financial future. Anyway, enough crapping on from me. You can learn more by going to petewargent.com, or you can follow Pete on Facebook and Twitter. I'll have all the links in the show notes over at andysocial.net. But for now, please enjoy this really, really cool chat with Pete Wargent. Why the hell did you want to be a chartered accountant?
Yes, a really good question. So when I graduated, I went to university. We didn't get any sort of career guidance at school. We weren't pushed in any particular directions by our parents either. And so there's a couple of reasons. I mean, accountant is like a default career for people who've got no real other ideas of what they want to do in life. And it's a good grounding. But the other thing that was a driver for me is that I'd spent quite a bit of time in Australia as a backpacker and working in Mascot in Sydney as a backpacker. And back in those days, chartered accountant was on the skills shortage list. So you got 60 points on if you wanted to apply for permanent residency in Australia. So, and you got an extra 30 points if you'd done 3 years experience with a firm. So, Yeah, so when I went back to London, that was a big driver for me to get 3 years experience, do all the exams and qualifications, and then and that's pretty much what played out. So I got the qualification, put in an application to come back to Australia on a permanent basis, and yeah, luckily just scraped over the line. I think you needed 120 points, and I think you got an extra five if you could speak English, which I just about scraped through on that test, and yeah, that just got us over the line. So yeah, so that's actually, that's a big driver for me, was coming back to Australia where I'd originally come as a backpacker to play cricket.
Oh, I tell you what, so many stereotypes there straight off the bat. But was it a case that, I mean, when you were here and you sort of identified that this is the open door, this is the avenue to sort of pursue to be able to get back here on a more permanent basis, was it to play cricket, or was there a sort of, you just fell in love with the place and you sort of thought this is an area that I wanted to sort of spend a lot more time, and what were the sort of the drivers for you to come back?
Yeah, it was the latter, really. So I'd always had this thing growing up that I didn't want to do the same as everybody else. So I had this big thing that I wanted to go and live overseas, and I came to Australia originally. I had a few Aussie friends from playing cricket with them, and I used to play the same cricket club as Alistair Cook, who was a bit younger than me, but a really good friend, and obviously an outstanding player and person. And I come over to Australia as a young Pom, didn't really have many friends and family around as support. So originally I found it, you feel a bit isolated when you're young and traveling. But it was only really towards the end of that year that I'd spent, you know, built up a bit of a group of friends through cricket, and I'd loved the cricket, which was really good and improved my game no end. And we went on a bit of a boys' holiday, essentially. We hired an old Ford Falcon and drove up the coast to Byron, and then Gold Coast and up to Noosa. And it was only really at the end of my trip that I started to think, oh, hang on, you know, going back to the English winter, you know, and I've sort of made a really good group of friends here. I could see the benefits of the lifestyle. That's what really got me thinking, is maybe I should be looking to come back here on a more long-term basis.
I'm trying to think with this accountant sort of thing, and obviously that was a light bulb and an opportunity for you to be able to come back long term. But had you had a fascination with numbers? Do the numbers sort of get you going? Is there something that comes back to your childhood where you sort of had at least a little bit of an interest where you could see the appeal in sort of, I mean, even when you came over as a backpacker, were you sort of you know, being so, quite smart with the way that you spent your money and or calculating with your funds? Was it sort of a history to the appeal of working with numbers?
I always loved numbers at school. So at junior school, I couldn't wait to. The first thing I always did was the math stuff. I wasn't so keen on some of the more sort of arty subjects at that point. So there was definitely an interest in numbers. I wouldn't say I was particularly good with money as a young bloke, because like a lot of young Brits, I spent pretty much all of it in the pub. I wouldn't say I was a role model from a personal finance point of view by any means. But there was definitely an interest in numbers, and I could see how accounting is a pretty good career for people who've got not really sure what they want to do, because you can go on to become a financial controller or whatever it is, or a CFO, but you can pick your industry depending on what you're interested in. And yeah, as I already mentioned, I suppose the points for the permanent residency application was a big thing too, because if you looked at the stuff that was on the skill shortage list, chartered accountant was 60 points. The other big ones were things like a hairdresser and stuff like that. But wow, if you've ever seen my profile pictures, there was no way I was going to get 60 points on that front. So it was pretty much accounting. I was sort of funneled in that direction, and it worked out pretty well. And, you know, it's a bit of a bread and butter career. It can be boring at times. There's good aspects to it as well.
Was it when you're sort of more in the depth of the accounting world and your career, sort of being an accountant, that you sort of started to, I guess, see how it could apply in your personal life as far as your personal finances and things like that? Was it sort of later on down the track that you could kind of see the connection and see how you could value personally out of being able to sort of strategize and approach the way that you personally take care of your money.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so in terms of where I'd come from, so my parents were both public sector people. So my mum was a teacher, and my dad worked in it was corrective services, so essentially like a social worker or probation worker. So we didn't really come from a background where investing or personal finance was much talked about. But when I went to work in London, I originally went to work for one of the mid-tier firms. The mid-tier accounting firms, they don't have the big listed companies. They often, their main big clients are high net worth individuals. So you start to work with people like that, and you see their accounts, and you start to, it kind of starts to click. So you realize, you know, the people who are successful with their money, they have assets and they have multiple business interests and things like that, which is very different to the background I'd come from. And that's how you start to learn about the idea of your, you know, your personal balance sheet, essentially. So you've got your assets, and then you've got your liabilities, which for most people, I suppose, is these days credit card debt and their home loans and things like that. And it just it definitely gives you a good grounding in terms of starting to understand how better to manage your money.
What was the appeal to sort of have this moment? I mean, for a lot of people, it's only when they sort of get pushed into a corner, whether it be a tragic sort of financial situation that they find themselves in, or the other end of the spectrum where they may have some lofty goal that's come into their life, or they've got a passion or something that they want to work towards, and then they start to think, well, actually, I've got nothing to work with here, so how do I build something? Was there what sort of circumstances did it sort of fall into play where it clicked in and started making a lot more sense for you, or there was a bit more of an appeal to sort of go, okay, well, what do I need to do now?
Yeah, I think, well, you've hit the nail on the head. You see, for almost anything in life, if you've got a big enough why, then you'll find the how. And that, for me, it was once I qualified as an accountant, I went to work for one of the big four firms, and the hours were very long, and the work was pretty stressful, to be honest. And that was suddenly became the driver for me. It's like, well, I don't want to be doing this for the next 30 or 40 years, because it'll probably put me in an early grave. So that's what I started thinking, right, if I don't want to be stuck in a traditional 9-to-5 job with very long hours, working weekends and so on, well, I need to find a different way. And that's what got me reading about the ideas of spending less than you earn, investing the difference in, be it in the stock market or the property market or setting up your own business. There's multiple ways you can go. But if you want to try and create some kind of level of financial independence, then you're going to have to do something a bit different to everybody else.
You didn't go and stick it to your boss and just say, I'm walking out and that's it. I'm going to start my own life, or reduce my own hours and find my own way. Obviously, it's a bit of a long-term strategy. And I think that's a common theme with a lot of this kind of stuff. And it's around mindset, where you sort of got to think, I've got to have a plan, but this is not something that's going to happen overnight.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting how the world's changed, because even just flicking back through, you know, all of the podcasts that you've done over the years, if you look at how many people these days are able to create a second income through their skills, be it through who knows what, musicians or sound engineers or artists, or there's any number of things you might do, and because we've got technology and connectivity, I mean, you can actually set up a new business overnight these days. But it's different for different people. See, for me, even though I'm a risk taker to some extent, I still wanted to have the good foundation of assets behind me before I took the leap, because I wouldn't say I'm a naturally entrepreneurial sort of person, like a lot of accountants, I suppose. Whereas some people who are, you know, one of my friends from university, he pretty much didn't even finish his degree and he was straight into entrepreneurship. So some people are more comfortable with taking the risk. For other people, they need more security behind them.
Was it for you, property was probably the first thing that you started to look at, or did you start, you mentioned property and stocks as being two examples, but I guess to begin with, and a lot of, I guess, the stereotypical sort of first few steps that a lot of people do is they go and aim towards that first home. And I think when people make the mistake is it's, you know, they envision that first home as being the home that they own forever. And they throw all their money into it to do it up and make it glamorous and whatever it is. But I guess some, and sorry, gone off on a tangent straight away there, but was property the first thing for you as far as that sort of strategy of sort of building up an asset sort of portfolio for yourself?
It was stock market originally. It was only when I met my now wife that changed for me a bit, because I guess being an accountant, I went into industry and I used to write annual reports for listed companies, and I used to write stock exchange releases. So I felt that, you know, I should have a natural disposition towards understanding companies and investing in the stock market. But when I met my then girlfriend but now wife, and she was from a different background to me. Her parents were farmers, and they always had this belief that you buy land and don't sell it because of the strong compound growth effect, essentially, or capital growth that you get from owning good quality assets like that. And she'd actually bought her first home when she was 21 and paid off a big chunk of the mortgage, and she was absolutely miles ahead of where I was. So that was a bit of a light bulb moment for me. And from that point onwards, we both together then also invested in property. So, there's different ways to go. The tax system in Australia pretty much favours people going into property and shares above all else. I suppose the third string to your bow for people who have an entrepreneurial side is to set up your own business as well. So if you can combine those three things, you can create something pretty powerful.
And from sort of those moments where you're sort of looking, as you're sort of still working as an accountant and sort of thinking a bit more long term, as far as, you know, in the current position that you're in, you've got a lot of extended hours, you're sort of really slaving away, but this is not a long term strategy for yourself. I mean, what sort of time frames are we looking at from where you start to have these first thoughts to when you're eventually able to take that step and make those changes as far as what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I started my accounting career, I guess, when I'd graduated. I'd done a year as a backpacker, so I suppose I would have been 22 or something like that. But in Britain, the way the system works, you do another 3 years with an accounting firm before you can finish all of your exams and be time qualified. So I guess I would have been probably 26 by the time that I was a qualified accountant. But at that point, your income takes a huge leap. You can go on and become a supervisor or a manager, and essentially you become a higher rate taxpayer to all intents and purposes. And so I suppose with two of us earning high incomes, that gave us a real, we were quite fortunate, we had a head start there. I guess I would have been about 28 when I sat down with my now wife and just said, right, well, you know, if we don't want to be doing this for the next 30 or 40 years, we need to make a plan to do something different. And I finished my last full-time role when I was 33. So, we went at things pretty hard and we had a bit of luck along the way. But, these things, you get a lot of people tend to think very black and white in terms of financial independence, but it's really a journey. That's the key. It's to think of it more like a snowball. You know, you're starting off small, but as things tend to gather pace over time, the results over time become much bigger than you even dared to dream about when you started out. So that's the key concept, is the multiplication effect or the snowball.
And I think that's a hard thing for a lot of people to grasp if they don't spend the time to sort of really think about the concept, because and I've certainly been a victim to this in the past, where you have these sort of lofty dreams that don't make a hell of a lot of sense and may not be terribly realistic. And I think it might be Tony Robbins in his Money Master the Game, I think that's the book, where I think at the beginning of the book he talks about things such as financial freedom, financial independence, etc., and sort of really forces you to start thinking about, like, what do you want? And, like, start thinking, you can think, this lofty, unattainable sort of dreams that you have, but being able to break it down into more realistic chunks. And I think a lot of people sort of think that if they can't get it straight away, or, you know, and you'll use the stereotypes of a big house and cars and all that sort of stuff. And if you can't get it straight away, then it's not for me. It's for somebody else. It's more fortunate than I am. And I guess that comes back to a little bit of that sort of victim mentality, or not being sort of proactive and not sort of thinking about what you can control versus what you can't. It's just something that a lot of people just struggle to grasp, as far as understanding that if you're able to take your time and sort of incrementally sort of work your way along, that you'll eventually reach that goal, as long as you've got a bit of a plan in place.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you actually look at the way compound growth works, if you're not familiar, the basic concept is that if you've got $100 and it increases by 10% in year one, you've got $110. But if it increases by another 10% in year two, then the increase in year two is on a bigger base, mm. and it goes up by more. So now in the early years, that doesn't seem like much. But if you actually project that forward over time, the results, our brains are trained to see things in today's numbers. We find it very difficult to grasp this concept that your money can start to multiply. And if you're thinking of a more practical Aussie example, back in the 1800s, a guy came over from England with 24 rabbits. A few of them got away, and because each rabbit could breed more rabbits, within 10 years there were a couple of million being shot every year, with no effect on the population whatsoever. And that's compound growth in action. And it's exactly the same with personal finance. So as Tony Robbins explained so well in that book, that is definitely well worth the read if you can get your hands on a copy. But another thing that Robbins points out as well is that the lifestyle you want might not be quite as expensive as you think. If you actually break it down in terms of, what do you actually need to live a great lifestyle, if you actually put a number on it per month, it might not be anywhere near as high as you think. So the key, as you said, is to get started and just start building your way, and you'll get there eventually, as long as life doesn't get in the way, which it does for a lot of people.
And I guess the other thing that, I think a lot of people struggle with is when you think about, that concept of compounding growth. And as you mentioned, like, to begin with, those first few years, you're not going to see a great deal. I mean, I watch the monthly interest, be calculated on my balance, and I go, oh yeah, okay, all right, I don't know how this is going to really sustain me for the rest of my life. And then, but obviously for the long-term strategy, and you're looking at decades, then it's going to be quite significant. And I guess for people, they've got to try and understand, it's that sort of delayed gratification. People want money now, and they want to be able to spend money now, but they also, you want to be able to protect your long-term as well. And so that's a really difficult thing. And I think the common theme with a lot of this stuff, and speaking to a lot of people, a couple of people that obviously Michael Yardney, but Stephen Ryan as well, a lot of this is around mindset. And it's just, if you can get your mind in sort of the right sort of angle and looking at it the right way, then it's half the battle. The numbers are sort of, it's important to have the financial education, but I think if you've got the right mindset, it's sort of, that's probably the biggest challenge that most people have.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of different aspects to it. So, putting a big enough value on your own time is a big part of it. So some of that comes down to self-worth, which is a difficult concept to pin down. But, if you don't value your own time, then your employer's not going to. So that's a big part of it. Another thing as well is that, most people, if they start to achieve a level of success that they don't feel comfortable with, one way or another, they find a way to self-sabotage. So, that's a well-recognized trait. So I suppose the classic example that's given is when people win the lottery, and that they win or Powerball or something of that nature, and they come into a lot of money. If they've never been in that situation previously, they've got no real context for what to do with that money. You very often find that within a few short years, they're back to where they started. So the concept that people talk about sometimes is like a thermostat, and you've got a certain, your wealth level is set to a certain thermostat temperature. And if you start to exceed it, then you somehow find a way to get back to the temperature you're comfortable with. So as you said, the key really is to actually raise that thermostat, or your self-worth, of what you believe you're worth. And that's really a mindset thing. So it's not, that's not about technical, you know, investing skills or anything like that. It's actually about improving yourself first, and then the numbers can follow later.
I was just thinking, especially on the example of people winning the lotto, I just got a chunk of money the other day. I won't disclose to the listeners how much it was, but it wasn't a dramatic amount, but it was enough that I need to be a little bit careful about what I do with this money. And, I'm lucky that I've been exposed to a lot of really fantastic people over the years, especially through this podcast, but, just reading and listening to other podcasts and sort of learning and becoming a better person, that I've been able to stop myself before I start basically making it rain and start spending the money left, right and center. Because I think for a lot of people, it's if it's not sort of your expected weekly or fortnightly or monthly revenue that's coming in and allocate it to the normal things such as bills and utilities, etc. People, it's very tempting to sort of suddenly have a million ideas of what you could spend this money on. And it comes down to that concept, and I've seen you speak about it as far as the assets and the liabilities aspect, where, you know, for me, the instant sort of reaction is, I can spend this money on this, but there's very little return on investment apart from maybe a quick short-term thrill. And I've got to sometimes, sometimes that's validated and that's completely fine. And we can do that because we've got to enjoy, I guess, the journey along the way. But for me, it's really challenged me over the years to start thinking of what can I do with this money to ensure that it is providing something to me long-term and actually be able to create something from this money.
Yeah, for sure. And the classic case is very often when people inherit money from either grandparents or parents or whatever it is. And then people think, well, you know, I've worked hard. Maybe I deserve a holiday, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then, maybe the car needs an upgrade. So you get a couple of new cars. You find things that you've got a little mental shopping list of stuff that you want. But if it's going to be things like cars, you generally find that 5 or 10 years down the track, they're not worth very much. Mm. So even in the short term, you get some enjoyment. But it's effectively compound growth working against you, not for you. It's tough because, I definitely think if you'd have said to the 21-year-old me, you know, you could have given me practically any sum of money and I would have found a way to spend it, because these days there's any number of things you could do with your money. So that's where it's a mindset shift in terms of, putting money to work for you rather than spending it on stuff that depreciates. So that's the big challenge. And I've recently written a book on wealth. It's called Wealth Ways for the Young, and it's actually targeted parents for what to teach their children about money. And there's also a section for teenagers, because the thing is, nobody tells you this stuff when you're at school, or very rarely do they. It's also the most important time to learn stuff, because the younger you are, the more time you've got on your side to make compound growth work for you, to try and avoid the traps of credit card debt. So the earlier you can start, the better.
I'm just having flashbacks to when I was in high school and just what I was learning at the time. And I remember we had an accounting subject that for me didn't last terribly long. But, all I can remember is the old ledger book, the exercise book, and learning what a credit and a debit was. And I think the rest of it sort of just glazed over very, very quickly with me. But I think the big thing that was lost at that time, and I'm sure it was very similar to you as well, where there was not a lot of sort of parallels to people's personal life. There's no real life examples as far as that were relative to somebody who was 14, 15, 16 years old and what was going on in their life. It was more about the hypotheticals of being out and having a job later on down the track, and something that was very distant to a lot of people because they couldn't appreciate what life is going to be like in the future because they haven't experienced it yet. So to be able to have it relative to the person at that point in time in their life, I mean, that's what's critical and what has been missing a lot of the time.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I've tried to do when I wrote my first book back in 2011. It's to say, well, look, all of the information in the world is out there. I mean, you could go to ASIC's website, and there's all the information on everything you need to know. This is what your superannuation is, this is what a bond is, this is the stock market. But the information is so dry that nobody will ever read it. So what I've tried to do in my first book is say, okay, I see a lot of books are written for a US audience as well, which doesn't really help when you're trying to learn this stuff in Australia. So I made it Australian specific in terms of, you know, this is the tax system, this is how property works in Australia, and investment property in particular, because we've got different tax rules here. And this is how the stock market works. This is how super works. And this is how, if you want to set up your own business, this is how you go about it. But actually to put some real life numbers on these things, because if it's just a load of theory, people are going to tune out and go to sleep very quickly, as you said. So, that's what I tried to do in my first book, is to say, okay, well, if you're talking about financial independence, then let's say, for example, if that means, you know, it's different for different people, but if you need, whether that's $50,000 a year passive income, or if it's 100 for people, whatever it is, you know, you might need to multiply that number by 20, say, and if you can have a net worth in that kind of region, then that's the battle won. So once you start putting a number on it, then you've got a real goal that you can work towards. But as you say, an awful lot of the information out there when it comes to personal finance seems so boring or dry that people just, they tune out very quickly.
Oh, I'm one of them. Like, I'll put my hand up straight away. It's a little bit self-deprecating, but I believe I've got the attention span of a goldfish. Like I jump towards the glittery, shiny things, and a new idea comes along and sort of run at that for a moment and then get distracted by something else. And it's the same with, I mean, I went through this at school, really sort of struggled to sort of maintain attention with what was going on around me. And but what I found, and it's just been really amazing, is the way that people have been able to communicate in a different way that sort of makes it relative to the person. And, you know, I've got your ebook, Your Wealth in Abundance. And I started reading that the other day, and I started trying to get a bit of a grasp of some of the stuff that you've been doing. I've been following you for a while as well, but I mean, the way that you write is appealing in the sense that you're not sort of, it's not lofty. It's not unattainable sort of information where I have to have a level of prior understanding to be able to get to a baseline to then be able to absorb the content. And, you know, other books out there that sort of, like, you know, the Rich Dad Poor Dad book, and we mentioned Tony Robbins, I'm just trying to look around on my bookshelf here, there's heaps. And the way that they're written, and what sort of the way that you sort of communicate as well, is just very sort of natural, but it's relative to your basic everyday dummy like myself. That's what makes it a hell of a lot easier to sort of get on board and also get excited about it. And I think that's the appealing thing, because you can start to see the dots connecting. You go, I understand how I can actually do it. Like, I don't just understand the theory and go, I understand why it works. I understand how it can work for me.
Yeah, and I think it's not trendy these days, because if you look on online, there is so much information, and there's so many super complicated strategies, and there's an awful lot of financial jargon, and it's not very cool or trendy to say it. But the reality is, when it comes to personal finance, investing, probably 90 to 99% of it is just common sense. But one of the things you don't realize when you're younger, you look up to a lot of the information that's out there, and people who are writing about you know, investing and finance, and an awful lot of those people have achieved very little themselves. They're just putting out theory, I suppose. And and this is one of the key messages I try to get across in my book about financial principles for young people. Is that probably, you know, and I said, look, right at the beginning of the book, I said, look, I get that a lot of people don't want to read a long book about finance. So if you're not going to read it, here's 20 bullet points. And if you're child just does these 20 things, I can guarantee you they'll be ahead of 99% of people financially. And a lot of it, no, I mean, in fact, all of it is common sense and simple. So, you know, just the really basic stuff, like spending less than you earn, not taking on credit card debt, not taking out car loans, picking a high growth, low fee super fund, you know, choosing a career carefully, because the world of, I suppose, careers is changing too, with some of them becoming more in demand and some becoming obsolete. You know, it's not complex stuff, a lot of this. But these days, I think in the financial services industry, sometimes people want you to think it's more complicated than it really is, because therefore you'll have to engage them. Mm. But I would say an awful lot of it is just common sense.
I think another thing that I've sort of learnt over the years is, I wouldn't so much blame my parents, but my, you know, generations of I guess, interpretation of money and how we talk about it around the tables, stereotypically, grandparents, etc., and I guess different eras over the last 100 years of, you know, up in, you know, depression and financial crisis and all that sort of stuff over the years. There's a real sort of... there's not a lot of, and you sort of mentioned it earlier, as far as risk-taking, there's been very little risk-taking, even in conversation, as far as the possibilities. And I think that one of the appealing things that has happened over the last few years is not only is it digestible and relatable, but I think it's almost given people a green light to actually think about this stuff in a more liberating way, is instead of something that is only discussed behind closed doors between, you know, certain people, and it has to stay relatively quiet. And, you know, money's a personal thing and it's quite emotive. But I think if people are allowed to sort of think big picture and it's a blue sky and start thinking sort of long-term and thinking about the possibilities, then it's sort of, at least for me, I found it quite liberating that there was so much I could do.
Yeah, so I mean, you touched on a really good point there. Think about our parents' generation. So, I mean, just to take the example I'm most familiar with, my own parents. So they were born at the end of World War II. So in Britain, we had the war finished in 1945, but you know, way beyond the war, right into the 1950s, they still had rationing. So you know, it's not like people were born into a time of abundance, and then they came into the workforce. At the time, there was a big surge of baby boomer generation, and it was a time of massive inflation. And when people took out their first home loan, they had interest rates that spiraled up into 12, 13, 14, you know, 17%. So it was a very different time. And there was a lot of, certainly in the part of the world where I grew up in Sheffield, there was a lot of fear about unemployment because the coal mines were being shut down, the steel industry was shuttering. So it was. There was very little talk about taking risk. It was very much about job security. You pay off the home, get out of debt as quickly as you possibly can, even though it would have taken years with the lower wages back then. And it was all about the pension. So you basically worked till 65, and then the pension was guaranteed for life. Mm. So. You know, and that. So our parents were really just the product of the situation. They found themselves in, but the world has changed a lot since then. So we've actually got the opposite problem these days, low interest rates. So as you already touched on, money in the bank doesn't really earn anything. Yeah. And even the money that you do earn gets taxed. So you need to think of things a little bit differently. And certainly in Australia, the system is skewed towards real estate and the stock market. And if you've got something you're passionate about or a skill set that you can monetize, the internet now allows you to do that. So I know that you've lived outside of one of the big capital cities for some time because people can work from home more easily than they used to be able to. So that's one thing that's changed. So I'm in Noosa today, and I guess you're outside of the city as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different stuff you can do these days, and especially there's a lot of talk about you know, real estate being the only route to wealth and stuff in Australia because we've just been through a property boom. But don't forget, you know, the very quickest way to financial independence is actually if you can set up a business that generates income for you on a repeat basis or passive income basis, then well, that's you can do that overnight if you've got an idea and a skill set. So there's a lot of stuff you can do these days that's very different from what our parents faced.
And I think I think also as these sort of these perceptions of, well, not perceptions, but the realities around, I guess, jobs and security and what people, I guess, approach everyday life as compared to sort of previous generations, as far as, you know, I mean, my father, he's worked for the same government agency for the past 40 years, and he's sort of weighing up now, oh, do I retire yet? Nah, might leave it another couple of years and just see how much longer he can stretch it out for. But, you know, a lot of people sort of have that or have had that perception of job security, being able to stay with the one employer basically for their entire career, so to speak. But these days, you know, job security isn't the same. And I think initially a lot of people panicked because of how quickly everything was changing with technology, etc. But as you've mentioned a few times, it's just, you know, with the internet, it's just opened it up so much more for people to be able to create other things that psychologically just take the edge off, take the pressure off, that if something does go wrong, you have a number of other backup plans, and it might not be able to completely fill the gap if you lose a job or you decide to make a dramatic change, but it just takes a little bit of the edge off to know that you haven't got all of your eggs in the one basket.
Yeah, and it is scary in some ways because a lot of careers that were traditionally thought of as safe have suffered from automation. So, it's difficult for our generation, but think of our kids, you know, they're seeing how quickly the world is changing. And for them, it's very difficult to know, which careers to choose and so on. And there are some different skills you need as well to set up an online business or a remote business. So in terms of, you know, how do you attract an audience and how do you convert them into new clients and how do you deliver the services? So there's a whole, you know, it's a very rapidly changing beast and there's a lot to learn. But as you say, I mean, one of the good things these days is the flexibility. You mentioned, some cases in point with our parents. You know, my dad did the same, worked in the same career from 21 to 65. You know, it's that's much less common these days, but it's, which is a good and a bad thing. So we've got more choice, which is great. You know, we could move to any part of the country. And in fact, we've already seen that in Australia through the mining boom. A lot of people moved over to Western Australia or the Northern Territory. But when the mining boom finally peaked and we went into the downturn, people moved back to Sydney and Melbourne. So, that's a good thing in terms of following opportunities. The downside, and as you know yourself, the modern curse is that we've actually got too much choice sometimes, and it's difficult to know, well, where should I be living and how should my life look? So we spend, as you can hear by my accent, I spend a big chunk of my year over in Britain. But the grass isn't always greener. You know, sometimes having too much choice is actually a difficult thing too.
Well, I think for me, sort of living away from Sydney for the last several years, and we sort of spoke about this earlier in the piece, where you're kind of forced to be in an environment where there's not as many options, there's not as many sort of temptations right at your fingertips where you can walk out the door and suddenly there's a whole number of things that you can spend your money on straight away, or events or things that are happening. And I think one thing that's really difficult, and I definitely don't want to go down this rabbit hole because I've gone down it so many times, I'm sure the people are listening are sick and tired of me crapping on about it, but I think just technology these days and things such as social media and being able to see how each other live or appear to live certainly adds an element of anxiety to no matter where we are in the world, and thinking that, you know, we've got to be doing what other people are doing. And so that usually equates to spending money, whether it be spending money on tangible items or experiences or whatever it is, just so we're able to, you know, the old saying, keep up with the Joneses, you know. And you usually find that it's very short lasting and leads to a lot of pain. So it's interesting to see how people are trying to find that balance now with so much at our fingertips, you know, being able to instantly, like the other day, I had an idea. It was something I found interesting, and I thought, I wonder if that's available. And I just went on eBay, and within like 2 minutes I'd ordered it. And luckily it was a very cheap item, but I stopped myself afterwards, of course, not while I was doing it, and thought, oh geez, that was a little bit too easy for me to do. Like, you know, I should be able to have the idea, sit on it for a bit, stew on it, and then sort of think about, you know, the pros and cons of getting it. Do I really need it? But no, the thumbs just like quickly smashed the screen on my phone and here it is. And within a few days, it's already at my doorstep, and I'm not even living in a capital city. So
it's incredible. Well, the old sorry to cut you off there. The old Keeping Up with the Joneses thing, it used to be about the house you lived in and the car you drove. And in Britain, it was for people starting to take overseas holidays, because we always went camping in Wales. That was the thing. You know, the overseas travel just wasn't a big thing when we were growing up. But that's changed. So with things like Instagram in particular, I mean, I just browse back through my Instagram. It looks like I live an amazing life. Look at, but you've just got to remember that if you compare, other people's, I mean, that's their highlights reel. It's not their real life. Mm. And if you compare somebody else's highlights reel to your own behind the scenes, then it's never going to stack up favorably. So that's definitely a trap. And again, this is a key thing I talk about in my book, is that not only, if you think back to our childhood, money was essentially coins in your pocket, and then it became notes, and then it became a number on a screen, and now it's even more scary for young people, because you've got things like Afterpay, you can literally buy now, pay later, and you can see how easy it would be before young people have even had a chance to work out whether they're good with money or bad with money. They've got themselves into a level of debt, consumer debt. And if they're looking for evidence of being bad with money, well, they've got a credit card statement or an Afterpay bill that's there to support their belief. So that's why it's so important to educate people young about delayed gratification, because it's advertisers are very schmick now in terms of how they target you. And in fact, if you think about of your average day, you wake up, you're in front of a TV screen and a computer screen, and a lot of people's jobs are in front of a screen, and then even after work, people go to the gym and they're facing screens. It's the world is conspiring against young people in terms of consumerism, and that's probably it's the starting point for any person's personal finance success, is being able to spend less than you earn.
Give yourself a pay rise and spend less. I think that was one of the best things I heard early in the piece, where I thought, oh, wow, like I can actually earn more money by just not spending it on rubbish. I can be a little bit more disciplined. And I think the other thing that I learned that sort of gave me a bit of peace of mind was, delayed gratification is important, but I think it's also a case, it's not like what my grandparents would tell me when I was a kid, save your pennies and basically starve yourself borderline in order to save your money. You can still enjoy yourself along the way. And I think, what's that other book? Barefoot Investor, they sort of talk about a lot of that to begin with, to try and get people on board and try and bring them in to say, you can still enjoy yourself along the way. You just got to be disciplined about the amount of money you allocate towards that and ensure that you're still hitting all the other buckets that are necessary for your long-term strategies. And I think when people understand that, they know that they can still have some relatively enjoyable moments along the way. I think that sort of gets a lot more buy-in from your everyday person.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm glad you mentioned Scotty Pape's stuff there. He deserves a shout out, because he has done what previously seemed impossible, and he's brought personal finance from a niche subject into the mainstream. So you can go to Kmart or you can go to the airport,
it's everywhere,
and you can pick up a copy of his book. And I mean, there is nothing bad you can say about the advice in his stuff. It's absolute. Some of it is old school common sense, that's an overlooked thing. But he's done some amazing stuff for financial literacy, and not just for young people, for adults too. So fair play to him, and he deserves all of the success in the world for that.
I'll shift slightly, because I noted this down as a topic that I'll kick myself if I don't raise with you, because I talk to a few people, friends and peers, about money, and I'm trying to encourage the conversation a little bit more, not to talk about, exactly what people earn and what they're doing, but just sort of about strategy and thinking about ways to invest money. And I'm sure you follow Stephen on Instagram and watch his Peru adventures, what he gets up to. But he's always talking about the stock market, and I know that you've spoken about it, quite a bit in this conversation you have previously. I think in Australia, at least from my circles of friends and acquaintances and people that I've met along the way, property, and I think you sort of mentioned this, property seems to be the main sort of driver for investment, but stocks is also something to consider. what, I mean, talking on a very basic level, what are some of the initial things that people sort of have to think about or consider before they start to, I guess, take that first step? And where should they be looking? Because I think for me, the thing that I sort of look at first is things such as the index, rather than trying to buy and sell and trade and all that sort of stuff and potentially find yourself in a hell of a lot of trouble really quickly.
Yeah, so, yeah, God, there's a lot of moving parts there. I mean, so for, if you're not familiar, and a lot of people wouldn't be, so the index is essentially, there's a lot of different indexes, but in Australia, the All Ordinaries is one of the most, the one that you often see quoted on the nightly news. So, and there's also what is known as the ASX 200. So it's essentially, the index is essentially just a basket of Australia's top companies by market cap and liquidity. So what that basically means is essentially the biggest listed companies in the country. So if you one of the most popular products in Australia is Vanguard's Australian shares. So quick disclaimer, there's no financial advice here.
Absolutely.
But if you invest in an index, the general idea is that companies over time, they generate a bigger profit, and over time they pay out bigger dividends. So it's a share of the profits to you as the shareholder. And the general idea is if you own the index, well, if one of those companies falls on hard times, or maybe two of them do, it doesn't really matter because they drop out of the index and another company comes in. So the index can't go bust. You know, it's essentially only a massive cross section of Australian business. And if you live till you're 120 years old, the index is still there just doing what it does. Just paying out a greater share of profits to you over time. So, of course, from year to year, the index value can be up and down, and that's what you see reported Alan Kohler on ABC News every night. But actually, if you're taking a long-term outlook, the returns from owning a cross-section of all business have been very strong. So that's essentially that's a very low risk and long-term approach to investing your money. Now these days there are indexes that you can invest in all over the world. Vanguard, I mentioned, does an Australian shares product, but then they equally do an international shares approach. So the great benefit of this for the individual who doesn't know a lot about finance is that you don't need to spend a lot of time picking individual companies to invest in. So you don't have to pick the next Tesla or the next Google or the next Microsoft or whatever it is. You're essentially just owning a huge cross-section of business. So it's a lot lower risk from that perspective. So that's a really basic introduction. And to me, as an accumulator, I really like that. Now, it's not fashionable because these days everybody wants to be a stock picker and be the guy who picked the next big thing. But what people don't often tell you is when they pick the wrong company and it goes bust, you don't tend to hear about people's bad investments so much.
Well, you know, as we said, we're definitely not giving any advice, but I see I borderline think sometimes that Stephen's working for Tesla with the amount of Tesla talk that he's carrying on about on Instagram stories. He's going hard, but
so that's a really good case in point. So if you invest in a business like Tesla, it's never made a profit. So it's been around for 18 years. The stock market says that company is worth $40 billion. Give or take on any given day, but it's a company that's never made a profit. So, will that company start to generate profits in the future? Possibly, probably. Who knows? It's a speculative. That's called a speculative bet rather than an investment. Now, it may well pay off many times over, or it may not. So, as long as you're clear about that, there's nothing wrong with placing speculative bets. But I would say if you're starting out in investing, you wouldn't necessarily want to be risking a big chunk of your money on individual companies, because who knows what might happen. And if you're looking for some evidence to support that, well, take a look at if you go back to the news archives, so which you can find online in the libraries these days, look at Australia's top companies from 30 years ago, and most of them aren't here anymore. So the average life of a listed company these days might be 10 years before they either go insolvent or they get merged or taken over. But the genius of investing in indexes, now sure it's boring, but you know that the index is never, it's not going anywhere. So yeah, so look, it's about really understanding your goals and your risk tolerance, and then just putting in place a plan to reach those goals over time, instead of trying to get there in one big hit.
Well, and I probably should to be fair on poor Stephen, because I'm certainly putting him out here without him being able to talk on his behalf. But you know, I think the big thing, and you sort of touched on this, is that you know, Stephen's own story, and people can go back and listen to my chats with him. I mean, he's been able to build his portfolio and his sort of himself up financially, where he can afford to take more risks and be able to put money into different buckets and see what happens with it. And I think one thing that I've heard over and over again with stocks, and as far as picking things along the way instead of like an index sort of approach, is that you, before you make that decision, you sort of have to be mentally prepared that you may never get that money back. And
yeah,
I think
for sure,
if you can do
yeah.
that, then that's a different story.
Yeah, sure. Look, I know Steve really well, and he's a very switched on guy. He knows what he's doing. I'm just what I was hinting at is that for the average person, when you're starting out, if you don't really know what you're doing, start low risk and just learn as you go. So the old thing used to be, if you went back years ago, that people would put a small chunk of the money into gold, because if the gold market went nuts, you know, and you got a big win, then that's fantastic, but you haven't necessarily risked all of your money to do it. And now in more recent years, cryptocurrencies became the new thing, where people would buy, you know, a few bitcoins, and if they hit the jackpot, then great. But you have to have an acknowledgement that there's a potential, particularly with some of those other cryptocurrencies, that they become worth zero. So and that's there's nothing wrong with that, provided it's not your entire game. But I would say for most average people, having a more diversified approach works. So, and that's in fact what your superannuation effectively does. So you put your money into super, and a fund manager will own a big cross section of the stock market, probably some other investments as well. But there's no risk of, you know, them putting 100% of your money into something speculative. Now it's okay for people like Steve, because he actually understands the concept of risk management. He can afford to place some bets on, and he would own a cross section of tech stocks, and he'll only need one or two of those to pay off, and happy days. And he'll be off around South America for another 10 years, no doubt.
I think he's already got plans. I think people definitely need to follow him on Instagram for a bit of entertainment.
Yeah, for sure. No, I guess that was one thing that I did when I finished my last full-time job. I went traveling for 15 months in the end. But it's different for different people. You see, my wife would quite happily still be doing the same thing even today. Whereas for me, I couldn't wait to get back into Sydney and get back into business and doing stuff. So yeah, it's horses for courses. But from what I can see on Instagram, I think Steve's slotting into the nomadic lifestyle very nicely.
Very, very well. I'm keeping an eye on the time, but one other thing I was going to quickly ask you as well, just to get some thoughts, is I've seen a lot of attention on micro investing. One app that I've dabbled with in the past, just to see, you know, what it's like and whether there's any value to it, is what's it called now? Raise. It used to be called Acorns. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with a lot of these sort of micro investing sort of platforms out there. But for people listening, and you might be able to explain it better than me, but basically these platforms are just taking small amounts of spare change from payments that you make on a day-to-day basis and investing it into the stock market in what I assume is a very sort of similar sort of indexed approach, and obviously the same sort of concept as far as long term. But I've heard pros and cons with this. It's great for people that are sort of just getting used to it and getting used to the concept of investing, but also potentially there's fees and things like that that might come back and bite you. Have you had much exposure to this whole sort of thing?
Yeah, look, I don't. I suppose the thing is, as you mentioned, with any kind of investing, is you keep an eye on the fees. So if you've got a fund manager that's charging you 2% of your money every year, it doesn't sound like a lot. But actually, you know, if you're hoping to get a return of, say, 7 or 8% on average, and they're clipping out 2% over time, that's huge. And it's the same with share trading. You might think that every time you buy and sell a parcel of shares, if you're being charged a $20 brokerage, well, it doesn't sound like a lot, but you come the 30 June and the end of the tax year, and you look at your statement, and it's like, well, hang on, all those $20 have added up to be, you know, like $1,000. So it's the same with micro investing, is that if you're putting on a trade and they're charging between, say, $10 and $20 for a trade, that is, you just got to be careful that that doesn't become too big a lump of the pie, you know, and the same with any fees that are charged. So I think there's nothing wrong with starting small, but just be careful you don't give it all back in fees and charges.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that sort of, and even with people trying to pick super funds and whatnot, is I think that's where people sort of become the deer in the headlights, so to speak, where, you know, there's so many fees and things to consider, and things that seem to be low impact, but over a long period of time can actually be quite significant. And I think that's what, and I've seen it for myself in the past as well, where I sort of go, oh geez, like, where do I start? How do I even compare what fee means what, and what am I actually paying for, and what am I not, and what should I be paying for, and the additional insurances and things like that attached to it. And there's a lot to take in.
Yeah, sure. And in fact, if you don't know where to start, you could do a lot worse than read Scott Pape's book, because he talks about the concept of ultra low fee super funds. And if you're young, high growth funds, because you've got time on your side, so you can stomach a bit of volatility for the long term returns. So quite often with super funds, as you said, it can be hidden away in the small print. It's difficult for everyday people to understand, which is obviously the intention to some extent, but it's it just goes back to compound growth, you know. And if it's effectively the compound growth that isn't allowed to flourish by a fund manager clipping out their fees, that's what you got to be wary of. And for fund managers only delivering an average return, they shouldn't be charging you too much to do that.
Lots of things to think about. If people want to get started with your content, your books, obviously it depends on the person and what their circumstances are, but is there a good starting point?
Yeah, so I mean, the easiest way is just to Google me, Pete Wargent, and I've got a main website there, PeteWargent.com. And if you're a bit more nerdy and technical, I write a daily blog, just Pete Wargent Blogspot. But my main website will give you some ideas if you're interested in investing in property, or if you're interested in doing my coaching programs, or even just check out for something cheaper. I've written 5 published books, so there's plenty of content there to digest, and there's a lot of free stuff as well.
No, you've been busy. I didn't realise that you've written so many books. I mean, you haven't quite hit Yardney status yet. I mean, that guy went next level as far as the amount of books that he's been involved with. But you've certainly been busy, because it's something that I could have gone down a rabbit hole just talking about writing in general and putting together content, but we'll leave that for another time. But I'll put links to all the books, the blog and your website and everything in the show notes over at the website. But Pete, an absolute pleasure. I've been stalking you for a while, and it's been great to finally connect and have a chat.
Yeah, pleasure.
To dig into all things Pete Wargent and finance, you can go to PeteWargent.com. You can check out his blog, PeteWargent.blogspot.com. You can grab his free ebook as well, called Wealth in Abundance, which is via PeteWargent.com. Highly recommended, by the way. I've got that printed off at home, flicking through it, scribbling all over it, making all sorts of notes. Some really, really cool stuff. If you don't do anything else, at least grab that ebook. It's really, really good. Highly recommended, personally. Listen to me, please. You can also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by searching Pete Wargent as well. I'll have all the links in the show notes over at andysocial.net, as always. And depending on the podcast player you are using right now, you may be able to click through to the show notes by, you know, tapping away on that little screen of yours and clicking through onto those little clickable links. As I always say, reach out to Pete and all the guests that have been on the podcast. Just spend a couple of moments just flicking a little message or an email or whatever it might be, just to let them know what you thought of the podcast. It just goes a long way and validates the time that they've sacrificed to cop an ear bashing from me. I'm starting to say that way too much these days. Anyway, please go and check it all out, PeteWargent.com. Very, very cool, inspiring stuff. And check out that ebook as well, Wealth in Abundance. Few updates before we wrap this one up. Lord, 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 new album, 1st of August, 2019. It'll be available worldwide. Japan should be releasing the album 1 week earlier. I'm just waiting on some finalized details from those guys, but I'm not waiting any longer. We're getting our release dates out, and you guys can pre-order the album right now by going to lord.net.au/FI. As mentioned at the beginning of the episode, there are three bundle packs available. There is the CD, which you can elect to have it signed by us. You can get the CD and the T-shirt. And the third pack is a deluxe bundle pack, which is the CD, T-shirt, three patches, including a back patch, which we've never done back patches before. So I'm quite excited about this. And there is a additional bonus disc, which is the karaoke versions of the all the songs off the new album, plus some additional bonus tracks. So it's a cool little bundle pack. If you want to support this band in the best possible way, I would encourage you to get the deluxe bundle pack. That will be the biggest help for us. Lots of great goodies in there, and really appreciate everybody that's been pre-ordering so far. There's been a really great take up of all of the options, and I'm looking forward to half looking forward to packing them all up and sending them across the world. So that'll be, I might have to carve out a whole weekend to do that, but we'll see how we go. But yeah, go to lord.net.au/FI. All the details are there. The CD that we're offering for pre-order right now is the Australian edition of the album. Once this first pressing sells out, more than likely we will revert back to a global version of the album, which will exclude the bonus tracks that are on this first edition. So this is the Australian edition, which has three bonus tracks. One is an additional studio track called In Dreams, and there are two other bonus tracks, which are cover songs, John Farnham's Break the Ice and Ice House's Touch the Fire. So a couple of Aussie classics there. So if you want the exclusive editions of the new album, then you can go over to lord.net.au/FI. And at the time of this episode coming out, got a bit tongue-tied there, our new tour for the new album is going to kick off, I believe, this Friday. So maybe if you're listening to this on time, it'll be tomorrow. We're kicking off the tour the 21st of June at the Basement in Canberra. Then we're going to Brisbane for the 28th of June at the Backroom, the 29th of June at Badlands Bar in Perth for the Stormrider Festival, 5th of July at the Evelyn in Melbourne for the Forge Heavy Metal Nightclub. We're headlining that. The 6th of July at Jive Nightclub in Adelaide, and the 26th of July at Crowbar in Sydney for the first ever Forge Heavy Metal Nightclub Sydney edition. So make sure you get out and support that if you live in Sydney. We always need a few more heavy metal events, so get out there and support that, and support us, of course. Before we wrap it up, I've only got a couple of things to say. I've got a million things to say. Self-Starter Season 2 is out right now. Thank you so much for everybody that got behind the first episode of Season 2, which was with Chris Pachenko of Speed Metal Scrap and also Vanishing Point Fame. So if you're interested in checking out what Chris gets up to outside of the band, that's a great story there, and a lot of cool little insights from what he does on a day-to-day basis. The second episode, which is episode 32 in total of the Self-Starter podcast, is with Tennille Bond of the Establishment Bar in Dubbo and Au Revoir Vintage Van. So another great story there. That came out Monday, just gone, I believe. I'm just trying to get all my dates lined up with the recording of these episodes. So check that out. If you go to selfstarter.com.au, all the episodes are there. And you can also check it out in your preferred podcast player as well. But massive thank you for everybody that's getting behind and helping spread the word with those episodes. Just a lot of great stuff coming in the Self-Starter world, and just really enjoying what this is producing. So, and it's great to be able to connect with lots of different people outside of, I guess, the usual circles. So lots of cool things there. So go and check that out, selfstarter.com.au. And also, okay, cool. So, I'm sort of thinking on the fly here. Thank you so much for everybody that's been watching the podcast video series. So if anybody hasn't checked them out, I released a podcast video series called something like Get Into Podcasting, something like that. I can't remember. The videos are on Facebook. So if you go to my Facebook page, the Andy Social Podcast page, and click on videos. All 11 videos are there. Or you can go to my YouTube channel, just search for Andy Dowling, and you'll see the playlist, but also the separate videos there. So there's 11 videos broken up into small chunks, about 2 minutes in total each. So nice and easy to watch without too much time being taken out of your precious day. And it's a great way to get started into the podcast world. If you want to just learn the basics, and it is extreme basics. It's just a starting point, and there's plenty of other tutorials out there if you want to get into the depths and the detail. But hopefully this just sparks a little bit of inspiration and motivation. And I'm really enjoying the feedback I've had so far. It was a big task for me, a big challenge, a bit outside my comfort zone. And a massive thanks to Tim, who helped me slap those videos together as well. So I really appreciate it. If you know anybody out there that's been umming and ahhing or talking about getting a podcast started, send them the videos over. Hopefully it'll be a big help to them as well. But a massive thanks to everybody that's been sharing them around and watching them. Really, really cool and nice to see. I've been crapping on about sending out a mailing list. Haven't done it yet. I did send out a mailing listing for the band. So anybody that's on the band mailing list, I would have got an email about the pre-orders, and I will hopefully get the Andy Social one kickstarted very soon. So stay tuned for that. If you're not on the mailing list, you can sign up by going to andydowling.net or to andysocial.net, and there'll be a little pop-up window on your screen, and you'll be able to enter in your email address. Once you enter your email address, you'll get a PDF download of 20-odd pages of how to get started in podcasting, plus a bunch of other random content from my world. So if you want to have a little sticky beak, you can do that by signing up to the mailing list. But hopefully, once I find some time, I'll send out a mailing, little mail out to everybody and get started. And hopefully it'll just be a monthly thing, which will just recap on the month that was, from a podcasting world, from a band world, and just everything else that, is happening in my neck of the woods. So stay tuned for that. And hopefully something will be sent out soon. I think that's enough. All right. Till next week, folks. Take care. Ta-ta. Larry, please.